Well, good evening. If you want to go ahead and turn to Judges chapter 3. Judges 3, we will look at this chapter this evening together. Can y'all hear me okay? Do I need to make it closer? Okay. Wayne, good in the back? All right. If Wayne's good, I think we're all good. All right. So just do a quick review just to get us caught up. Welcome, everyone. And Judges chapter 1, we kind of saw the downward spiral that is going to occur throughout the rest of the book. You remember how Judah did well. They conquered everyone up until what scared Judah and Simeon. You remember in chapter 1? The iron chariots. They were doing just fine until they saw those iron chariots. And so what does that imply about Judah and the iron chariots? Absolutely. So it's not that the iron chariots were just too big of an obstacle to get over. They weren't depending on God. And so they saw that and shrink back. Some of the tribes did a lot worse than that, and they would make the enemies their slaves. Others, you see kind of the inhabitants, well, we're in the majority. We outnumber our enemies, and then you see that switch where the enemies outnumber them, and you end with Dan, where the enemy says, no, we don't really want you living here. So they wouldn't allow them to live in the valley, so Dan really didn't get an inheritance. So you see some good, great faith in Judah and conquering a big land and a lot of kings. And then you see absolutely zero faith in God in the tribe of Dan. So they failed miserably in what Joshua told them to do right before he died, what Moses told them to do before he died, is get rid of them and utterly destroy. And you just think about how the book of Judges would be totally different if they would have utterly destroyed the enemies and destroyed that influence that would be in their life. So instead of doing that, God says in chapter 2, 1 through 5, because you did not obey, I'm no longer going to drive them out. And so I kept my end of the covenant, but you did not keep yours. So now you will be tested by them. And so if you look at kind of there in chapter 2, verse 5, so verse 4, they lifted up their voices and wept, and they named that place Bochim. You have a footnote on what Bochim means in your Bibles?
Weepers.
So kind of a... because we're weeping and crying out to the Lord, we didn't do our job well, so they kind of named that city after weeping, or the weepers. So then, 6 through 10, there arose a generation that did not know the Lord. What do you think it means there when it says there arose a generation that did not know the Lord? Does that mean they had no clue who God was? Does that mean they had no clue about what God did in Egypt or the Red Sea or anything like that? Alan?
I think it means they worshipped other gods, to tell you the truth. They stopped worshiping God and started worshiping other gods.
Absolutely. Knowing the Lord is always connected with obedience to Him. And so instead of obeying the Lord, and if you really know the Lord, if you really fear the Lord, what are you going to do? Right, you're going to do anything He says and obey His will. Well, that's not important to them. They're going to live life the way they want to live, right? That's kind of the last five chapters of this book. They did what was right in their own eyes. You kind of see that at the beginning here, and just going to get worse and worse. So they did not know the Lord. Think about Pharaoh. Remember his reply when Moses and Aaron went to him and says, We are going to go make sacrifices to the Lord. And he says, well, who is the Lord? And who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? And so God is saying, okay, I'm going to tell you who I am, since you don't know who I am. And that's the book of Exodus, first part. And then in 1 Samuel chapter 2, just kind of to back up my point here, that I think knowing the Lord, maybe on the surface it means they didn't know who he was at all. In 1 Samuel chapter 2, talking about Eli's sons who were pitiful, right? Being nice. It says they did not know the Lord. Well, you would think, right, that Eli would have told them about the Lord. But that connection is they would kind of take the best of the meat that was supposed to be the Lord's and have it for themselves, very selfish-minded. And it says they did not know the Lord. So I think that helps us understand this passage and saying there arose a generation who just did not know the Lord. And so that kind of goes to the parents. Are we teaching that and helping our kids understand that? Yes, ma'am. Right.
We cannot be grateful when we don't remember what the Lord has done for us. And
right.
That remembering is a constant, it takes constant effort to remember.
Right.
To bring it to,
not a one-time thing.
It's not something that just stays there all night.
Yeah.
We have to stay in the Word. But they knew who the Lord was. They heard Joshua.
Sure.
All these years. So they knew who he was. But from the standpoint of knowing him,
yes,
and appreciating him, they did not because they forgot what he did.
Right. Good, great point. Dwayne, do you have, or Wayne?
Would it relate some to the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom? Because they may have known him, but they certainly didn't fear.
Right.
And that knowledge and wisdom are somewhat maybe interchangeable a little bit. Did it actually mean, yeah, they just kind of blew it up? And just said, well, this one over here is as good as this one. They didn't fear God. They didn't fear what he could do.
Right. And why are you going to fear the Lord? Well, the more you know him, right, the more in awe you are of him and respectful honor you are of him, you're going to do his will. So I think that all is tied. Let's keep moving. We had the cycle of the judges kind of explained there in chapter 2, verses 11 through 19, and we're just going to see this cycle repeat itself, I believe, about six times in this book. And so let's kind of go through that just really quickly. First, they would serve other gods. And then it says that God's hand would be against them, and he would allow the enemies to plunder them. So I think it's really important to notice in that that it says God's hand would be against them and God would allow the enemies to plunder them. Who's in control? It seems like, well, we're not able to match up and defeat this big enemy, this army that we're up against. They're stronger than we are. No, really, it's God's in control and he's allowing, right, this other army to take advantage of his people to teach them a lesson. So, they would serve other gods. What do you think they would do when they would go up against an army? Who would they be calling on? Probably the gods that they're worshiping, right? Does that make sense? So, as they are calling out and worshiping their new gods, how's that working for them? So, I think it's again, God is showing them who is the true God here. Don't call out to them because they're stoned, they're nothing. They can't talk, walk, do anything. So that's what you get when you serve those gods. They're not going to help you. Eventually, they would cry out to the Lord, and God would be moved to pity and would send them a judge or a deliverer to deliver them. And then when the judge died, they would turn from God and, it says, act more corruptly than they did before. And that's kind of the downward spiral that we're going to see in this book. We'll see that certainly in the people But I would also try to notice with you that it also happens to the judges themselves. I think you could say Othniel and Ehud, who we're going to study tonight, if I ever get there, are probably two of the best judges. And then you just kind of go Gideon. He started out good, then didn't end up great. Then you end with Samson, who was just a mess, right? So you even see that downward spiral in the leadership as well. So then 20 to 23, as we wrap up, God would use these nations to test Israel. So he's already said, I'm not going to drive them out. You're going to have to live with them, but this could be a help, right? They're going to test you. They're going to see, I'm going to see if you are really going to be for me or not. So going through a test or a trial has the opportunity to strengthen you, to make you stronger. So this could be a blessing, but they're going to obviously fail the test that God is using to try and help them. Anything else you would like to add? That was kind of a review of chapter 2. And one. Yes, sir.
After you said that God was in control, and he is, but in this case, the people are actually in control. If they actually did what God told them to do, then he would bless them and they would be in control.
Sure.
Because God would keep his promises. And he has kept his promises in this fact that they didn't follow him, so they were punished.
Good. Yes, sir.
One thing that's interesting to think about is if you look back to when the people of Israel came into the land, Rahab, all the people knew. Terrified because they knew what was coming. They knew who was behind the people. So what is happening, this cycle with the people, God is also demonstrating to the people around Israel, using them as an example. They still know who these people are. They didn't just forget
right.
Everything that led up to this. So God is getting glory through punishing his people that everyone around knows is his people. So he is demonstrating who he is and what's important to all of the heathens that are around Israel as well. So he's not just doing it for them, he's doing it for everybody that is without doubt who God was, because they were, you know, shaking in their boots before it happened. So
yeah.
It's not just Israel, it's God is getting glory by enforcing and correcting his people.
Yeah, great point. So God punishing his people would also be a demonstration and helping all the nation to understand who God is. And especially if you look at all these deliverances, you would think, well, there's no way that Israel could ever get out of this mess. But God said, I just need 300. And so everyone would understand, we need to fear Israel's God. So that's a great, great point. This is, I think we focus a lot on Israel, but this is a lesson for everyone. Great. Let's jump into chapter 3. And so 1 through 6, I just had here kind of Israel fails the test. You could make an argument that chapter 1, starting in verse 1 all the way through chapter 3, verse 6, is somewhat of the introduction to the book, where it shows how they failed in chapter 1, and then this is what's going to happen throughout the rest of the book in chapter 2 through chapter 3, verse 6. And then you get into the cycle of the judges, kind of starting after that through the end of 16, and then you got kind of an appendix section or a couple of different extra stories that show just how bad it got with the people doing what was right in their own eyes. So look at verses 1 through 4. Of chapter 3, and again, God is emphasizing for us that he left the nations to test Israel. He says, I'm no longer going to drive them out because you were disobedient. I would have, but you no longer served me. And so if I did drive them out and you didn't serve me, what would they learn from that? Or what conclusion could they come to? Yeah, so it really wasn't God the whole time after all. It was the great Israelites, and we're able to take care of the enemy, and we can, whether we serve God or not, doesn't depend on our success. So that's not going to help their obedience if he just keeps driving them out. So testing, I think it's usually seen in a negative light, and maybe that's a good reason for that. But I think it's also helpful to think about testing can be good, and it's good for us. God tested Abraham, right? When he told him, I want you to go sacrifice your son whom you love, Isaac. And he was willing to do that. The psalmist in Psalm 139, verse 23, the psalmist is praying to God and says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, or test me, some versions say, and know my anxious thoughts. That's kind of a prayer. How often do you pray that, or I pray that? For me, not very often. Do I ask God, I want you to test me, try me in this, so to know my heart so that I can be better for you. 1 Peter chapter 1, right? Kind of the going through the fire, there the gold is better on the other end. And then James chapter 1, consider it all joy when you fall into various trials. So trials, God testing them has the ability for them to be stronger. So that's the test. And then look at verse 5. And of course they fail miserably, right? So have all these nations, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites. And verse 6, they took their daughters for themselves as wives and gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. So notice not the progression, but the digression here. You see they lived among them, and then they married them, and then they started serving their gods. 1 Corinthians 15:33, evil companions corrupt good morals, right? Who do we choose to be around? Who do we enjoy being around? Is it people of the world, or is it God's people who are going to help us focus on Him and help our spiritual life? I think there's a good point here. Who you marry is extremely important, right? Because that's going to be, I would say, the strongest, the biggest influence in your life is going to be your mate. And so you have them marrying women who served other gods, and then what do you see them doing? Doing the same thing. So very, very important, and it's not just the marriage relationship, but any relationship. Who are you going to choose to influence you, right? And that's extremely important. I think we do the same things. Maybe sometimes we read this, they served other gods, like, I don't do that, right? We're kind of opposed to that. I don't bow down to any wooden idol or anything like that, so I don't sacrifice to anything. So, whew, good. I can ignore that. However, Paul, the apostle, steps on our toes, I think, in Ephesians 5, verse 5, when he says, covetousness is connected to idolatry. And I'd say kind of the love of money, the love of material things, love of the things of the world, that's all connected to idolatry. It's putting something ahead of the Lord. And I think we can go in this same track of we can live among it, and then pretty soon we're married to it, and then after that we're now serving the wrong thing. So it's easy for our goals and values to focus on the material things of this world instead of for the Lord. So I would kind of stop there and say that's kind of the introduction to the book. Any comments or thoughts through verse 6 before we run into Othniel here? All right. All right, maybe I'm talking too much. Yes, ma'am.
I think one of
merging and conforming to what they're doing. And I think it's easy to do that, you know, at school or in the workplace. Is, you know, you may start out really, you know, great and have a good attitude, and then slowly over time, people start to wonder, you know, I thought they were a Christian, or I thought this, or I thought they served God.
Right.
Good.
Great point. It kind of reminds you of Romans 12. You see the Israelites becoming the Canaanites, right? Don't be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good, acceptable, and perfect. So where's our mind? Where are we going towards? And all these things that happened in 1 through 6, isn't it a shame that God never warned them about doing these things, right? He just again and again, and they just ignore that and just do whatever they want to, right? And that's sometimes the same with us. So verses 7 and 8, we kind of see this first cycle, and I would say, and you'll have to agree, but I think this is the most complete cycle that we're going to see in this book, kind of what we see here in 7 through 11. It's kind of this cycle that we just saw in chapter 2, we're going to see fulfilled the most completely in this section here with Othniel. So they forgot God, and they served the Baals and the Asheroth. And again, you kind of ask the question, how does someone forget God? How would you answer that? How in the world did they forget who God was? Any thoughts on that?
They lost sight. They didn't focus on God, so therefore they lost sight. So therefore, he was put on the back burner, so to speak, and he was in the back of their mind.
Good. They're not meditating and thinking about him, talking about him all hours of the day. It's just they're minding their own business. Michael?
The guy in Wolverine would say that they got fat and happy.
Yeah. Right.
Look at this land that we conquered, and you start to forget about God. We all do that
Yes.
times in our lives.
Yes. One of the blessings of adversity is helping us depend on God. So they forget the Lord, and kind of what you focus on is what you're going to learn about, while the other things just kind of fade away. So they're focused on themselves and their prosperity and serving these other gods. So then God... Notice verse 7 and 8 there. God sells them into the hands of an idol-worshipping king. So since they loved worshipping idols so much, now they're going to serve, they're going to be enslaved to someone who does the same thing. And I would, again, kind of focus your mind on the gods that they were serving were unable to deliver them. So they'd hope they would learn that lesson well this time and say, okay, we really just need to focus on the Lord. He's the only one that can deliver. And God allows them to be punished for 8 years. So that's kind of the first subject there. So God punishes Israel, and then they cry out to the Lord in the beginning of verse 9. And then God sends a deliverer for them, or a judge. And what do we know about Othniel that we've already learned in this book and also in Joshua? Who's Othniel?
He's related to Caleb.
Good. Yeah, so he's Caleb's younger brother and also Caleb's son-in-law, right? Looking at that correctly. So... remember the deal that Caleb had? Whoever conquers this land will get my daughter. And so his younger brother says, okay, I'll do that. You could see kind of the faith of Othniel. He's already proven himself. I'm going to trust in the Lord to help me win the battles. And now you see him kind of taking the leads of and saying, okay, we need deliverance here. So he depends on the Lord. And again, I'd try to focus on the morality of The judges just go down. We start really good here with Othniel. And notice at verse 10, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel. When he went out to war, the Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand, so that he prevailed over that guy I can't pronounce. What is that emphasizing, verse 10? Yeah, absolutely. It's the Lord is the one who delivers his people through Othniel. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him. The Lord gave them into hand so that he prevailed. Since God was with him, they prevailed. So again, you get the emphasis on what the Lord is doing. And that's exactly what we read in chapter 2, verse 18. Right? That I will send. The Lord was with the judge to deliver them from the hand of the enemies. And then Israel enjoys rest for 40 years. And then Othniel dies. This is, again, I would say the most complete cycle we have in the book. And Israel loses a good man and a good leader of kind of a good good family. You think of Caleb and Joshua, and then how Othniel kind of helped lead the people here against King of Mesopotamia. Any thoughts on Othniel before we get to the left-handed Ehud? Yes, sir.
It's kind of crazy to think about God's long suffering, in that the people of Israel served this guy for 8 years, and then they cried out to God.
Right.
So for 8 years.
What took them so long?
Yeah, they're stubborn and hard-hearted, and God just sitting there waiting for them to repent.
Absolutely.
And yet, sometimes, you know, I can't be patient with somebody for a day. You know what I mean? So,
right.
Good thing for all of us to think about. With each cycle, God is so patient with them.
Great point. I'm trying to look chapter 2 where it says that God was moved to pity for them. And he just saw them. Where's that? Chapter 10? Or verse 10?
Chapter 10 of Judges mentions.
Oh, that he's moved to pity there as well? Okay. Okay, yeah. I just kind of see that maybe coming up again and again. See God's love for his people, even though he'd done so much for them. They deserted him and started serving other gods. And yet, I'll deliver. Yes, sir. Absolutely.
He is doing it proactively.
Great point. Great point. Yeah, so it's going to get so bad that the people are not even going to cry out to the Lord. Maybe they're so far removed from who he is. I don't know. That's a great, great point. Yes, sir.
Also, we talked about this last week a little bit, but the fact that he allows his name to get drugged through the mud for 8 years, you know, that he's allowing his people that just obliterated everyone to be subordinated by this pagan king. And he's allowing his name, like, well, where's that guy?
Right.
That just protected them all this time. It's not his fault.
Right.
It's these people's fault. And yet he's allowing his name to be blasphemed.
Sure.
So that people will learn.
Great point. Which kind of connects to your earlier point, is that this is for all, everybody. Soon as God's with Othniel, they don't stand a chance. Great. All right, let's look at Ehud. A lot to say about him. It's kind of the second cycle that we see already. Excuse me, from the slavery of the Moabites. So where do the Moabites live? Anyone remember? Right, so they are on the east side or the right, if you do east or right, whatever, side of the Jordan. And they're kind of over there with half-tribe Manasseh, Reuben, and Gad. And so you have the Moabites essentially trying to come over the Jordan and take some more territory. So notice verse 12, Israel went into sin, and notice the emphasis there, they did it again. They went into sin again. Satan's goal is always the same. We get into sin, then maybe we come out of it for a time. What's his goal? Let's get him back into sin again and again and again. We need to focus certainly on breaking the cycle of keep returning to sin. And I think some of that is a mindset. We can have a mindset of, well, I'm not going to be perfect, and so I'm always going to go back into sin, so I just might as well just give up and just ask God for forgiveness when that happens. Or do you have the mindset of, man, I hate sin so much, and I hate what it does to me. I'm going to do everything I can to stay away from it and destroy it. I'm going to get with people. I'm going to surround myself with people who are going to encourage me and help me get away from this sin. You see how that's different? That's the mindset that God wants us to have. We need to rely on God and focus on Him. So then 13 and 14, you see God strengthening the hand of, or the king of Moab. That's different, right? Who is God normally strengthening? His people, yeah. God strengthens Israel and they defeat it, or Egypt, or they defeat these kings over here. Now, again, you see God's in control. I think that's a key point in this, that he's going to strengthen not his people, but Moab. And he is going to help Eglon defeat Israel. And so, because Israel had done evil in the sight of the Lord, so kind of to Alan's point, they had the chance to stay away from sin. So because they didn't, now God has to punish. Does this remind you of a minor prophet, of God using a wicked nation to punish his people? And a lot of questions this minor prophet had because of that. I give you enough clues. Habakkuk, yeah. So why in the Babylon? They're worse than we are. Like, well, I'll take care of them, but first I got to take care of you. So it's not God is willing to do that and to strengthen and help his people learn that they need to turn to God always. So Eglon teams up with Ammon and Amalek. Moab and Ammon, right? They're brothers, kind of going all the way back to Lot. And the Amalek, that would be who? Who are the sons of Amalek? The opposite of the dwarfs, right? That's kind of the giants. So you have these two nations kind of teaming up with Amalek, and they're coming, and they defeat Israel at the city of the palm trees. So where is the city of the palm trees? Anyone know? Jericho. Yeah, or L.A. or Tampa or one of those, right. So you have this city that's taken over. And how long does Israel serve Moab? 8 years, right? So now they're serving not 8, but 18. I think there's a point there. Often when we go into sin again, we go deeper into sin than we did the first time. I think someone said it well when he said, sin takes us somewhere where we don't want to be and keeps us there longer than we want to stay. And that's kind of the idea. If we give into sin, and we give into sin again, it's usually just going to get worse and worse. So again, just the idea of break that cycle. This is why I think it's so dangerous for us to keep going back into sin. So they're there for 18 years. Sons of Israel cry out to God, and God raises up Ehud the Benjamite, and a left-handed man. Is there any other different versions than left-handed man? Literally, that is saying his right hand is deficient. So if his right hand's no good, then he must be left-handed, right? So that's kind of the idea, that he's a left-handed man. But I like that idea of, here's Ehud, who is no good with his right hand. And we're going to make a point out of that here in a bit. What does Benjamin mean? You remember why Jacob called Benjamin, Benjamin? Son of my right hand, and now we have Ehud, the son of my right hand, who's a left-handed. So I don't know if there's a play on words there or not. But we have Ehud, kind of the left-handed, not sufficient in his right hand. Interesting, I don't know what to make of this. There's a lot of cultures, I think still today, that if you're left-handed, they would see that as a really bad thing. And so I'd just throw that out there and let you catch. So I don't know if that's anything here or not. But by sending Ehud and to give the tribute, or the idea of he's forcing us to pay these high taxes and we owe him money, so Ehud, you take him to Eglon. And basically, I think the idea here, why would they send Ehud? Well, he's left-handed. He's a non-threat, right? He's not very sufficient in his right hand, so he won't be any threat at all to this king. So 16 to 30, really quickly, as I'm running out of time. Ehud, this is how he delivers, or how God delivers Israel through Ehud, I should say. He makes a homemade sword, which is sharp on both ends. And I think like a dagger. It says like a cubit in length, maybe 18 inches or so. Kind of tells you how big Eglon's belly is, but big man. So no one expected him to being a threat. Kind of puts it inside his cloak, so he'd put it on the right side, right, so he can draw it with his left. So Eglon, very fat man. Funny, Eglon means fat cow. So he seemed to want to live up to that name, so he just kept. Anyways, Eglon accepts the tribute from Ehud and sends the people with the tribute away. Thank you. You can go. And then Ehud announces, "I have a secret message." Most versions say that word "message" is really just kind of the idea of "I have a secret thing." Very ambiguous term. So I don't know if it's necessarily a message. I have a secret thing for you. Eglon, again, does not see Ehud as a threat, and he just says, "Keep silence," which is code word for everyone get out of here. It's just me and Ehud. So I can hear what Ehud has to say. So Ehud announces, "I have a message from God." And what do you see Eglon doing when he hears that? I would guess that took some effort from Eglon. But again, he has that seemingly, if I'm not reading too much into this, he has a respect for the Lord. That he gets up. It reminded me of Nehemiah chapter 8. You remember when Nehemiah gets Ezra to come and explain the law of the Lord, and they're reading from the Lord, and when he opens up the law, everyone stood up. So maybe he has kind of a reverence for, a respect for God's word. And so when he does that, Ehud uses that left hand of his and sticks the dagger into his belly and leaves it there. I'm not going to go into detail. He goes out and locks the doors behind him and just kind of makes his exit and escapes. And everyone else is thinking, man, Eglon's just kind of going to the restroom in there, and we're just going to give him his time and space. And then they wait and wait, and they're like, oh, this is getting kind of embarrassing for us. So you can kind of hear them, Eglomer coming in, and they see him dead. And so now, if you think about the Moabites at this point, their leader is dead. Now they're in complete panic mode, right? They're in disarray. They're leaderless. And so as this is going on, Ehud, who is probably long gone at this point, is kind of arranging and getting the troops ready for Israel. He blows the trumpet, and I appreciate this in Ehud. He leads Israel to fight the Moabites. And notice the message that he gives. The Lord has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hands. What do you appreciate about Ehud in that? Absolutely. How tempting it may have been to say, man, you won't believe what I did. I was able to kill him. I was able to sneak out, and I killed their leader, and I think now it's your turn. Go ahead and kill the army. You see him leading the charge. You say, this is not me. This is God using me in the ways that he does. So all the glory goes to the Lord. Israel's able to go seize the fords of the Jordan. Had to look that up. The fords, you probably all know this, it's kind of the shallow part of the Jordan where the Moabites could kind of cross over the Jordan easily and get over to the other side. So they kind of get those points where the Moabites could cross over and then make sure that's not going to happen. Israel strikes down 10,000 Moabites. No one escapes. So again, you see Israel dependent on God, gave them the victory, and they had rest for 80 years, which is twice as much than any other time of peace that we have in the book of Judges. Really quick, Shamgar, then I want to get to some application. He struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. What's an ox goad? Anyone know what an ox goad? Okay, yeah, exactly. So it's basically a kind of a stick with a kind of a prodding utensil on the end of it to, if the oxen are not moving, kind of poke them with it to get them going. You think that's a good weapon? Would you rather have a sword? Would you rather have maybe Ehud's dagger? The idea, God can use anything, right? And God is the one that's delivering, not Shamgar. So he also saved Israel. Back to this left-handed idea, and then the lesson will be yours. In Hebrews chapter 11, and I don't know if the Hebrew writer here is making a reference to Ehud or not, but in chapter 11, verse 34, that chapter of faith, and by faith these men did all these things, he says, some of the men quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword. It says, from weakness were made strong. I think that describes Ehud. From weakness, insufficient in his right hand, God made him strong. God used his left hand. Should remind us of us. In 1 Corinthians, Paul says, consider your calling, brethren, not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things that are strong. You think about us, we're a bunch of weak people. Nothing great about us, yet look what God is doing. God can use even people like you and me. 2 Corinthians 4, God uses clay jars to proclaim the excellencies of the gospel. It makes him so much greater, right, using people like us. You think about Paul. I know I'm out of time. Paul, the thorn in the flesh, where he says, God, please remove this from me. And he says, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Don't ever sell yourself short. God can do great things with you. You may be a one-talent man. You may be a two-talent man. Use that talent. Because God's with you, and God can do great things with a ox goad or with a homemade sword. Let's go and do that for the Lord. Thank you.